Thank you, Alex, for an opportunity to speak here. Hello, everyone. I'm very happy to be at Perimeter Institute. And I'm very excited to tell you about the current efforts to reduce the overhead of quantum error correction. If you're interested in a less technical talk, I will be giving a talk about quantum and chess later at IQC. Here, I hope that you know this talk is technical enough for this audience. So let's get started. Many of us in this room are thinking about theoretical foundations, how we can build quantum computers. However, for those machines to be useful, they have to be fault-tolerant. So here's how we typically envision building fault-tolerant quantum computers. We start with some physical system, for instance, superconducting qubits. Then we have some native operations between those qubits. In this case, those would be nearest neighbor entangling gates. And of course, those qubits and gates are imperfect. However, if the imperfections are sufficiently low, then using some clever techniques of quantum error correction and fault tolerance, we can engineer logical qubits and logical gates that are way better than physical qubits and physical gates. At this point, you can forget about the underlying hardware, and you can just think about ideal qubits, ideal gates, and with them, we can run our favorite algorithm, for instance, Shor's algorithm, and then we crack the RSA crypto system. So it's important to remember that if we want to run quantum algorithms that tackle relevant problems, we need to achieve error rates of the order of 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 15, because the number of basic operations that we need to implement in those quantum algorithms is of the order of billions. And currently, we don't know how to achieve such low error rates without quantum error correction. It is also important to stress that our quantum computers have to be fast. And if our quantum computer operates with the logical clock speed of the order of 1 megahertz, and it has of the order of million or tens of million of qubits, and if the error rates are of the order of 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4, then such a machine would still need to run for days, if not weeks, to tackle relevant problems like, you know, cracking the RSA crypto system or doing some useful quantum chemistry simulations. So it is a very important problem to tackle the space and time overhead of quantum error correction, because currently those overheads really make building those machines on the borderline of being impossible. And currently those overheads constitute the main roadblock to building quantum computers. And this brings me to the outline of my talk. And in this talk, I will be talking about approaches, how we can reduce the qubit and space overhead of quantum error correction. And I will be taking an angle where we want to realize quantum error correction with the currently available hardware, or the hardware that can be available in the foreseeable future. The outline of my talk is as follows. I will start very briefly reviewing the decoding problem. Many of you are familiar with it, and I will illustrate it with the example of the Torah code. And then I will go to the first part of my talk. I will tell you about the idea of erasure qubits. This part of the talk is based on the papers listed here. Here the idea is that we want to leverage the knowledge of the dominant noise in the system, and we want to transform quantum noise into pre-classical noise, some heralded noise, erasure noise. And in this last part of the talk, I will tell you a few words about single-shot quantum error correction. This can help with reducing the time overhead. And this part of the talk is based on the paper, on the two papers listed here. I will mostly illustrate it with an example of the 3D subsystem to our code, because I can draw nice pictures, and hopefully you will, it will be more intuitive for you to understand what single-shot error correction is about. But this property is also present in the recently developed family of good quantum LDPC codes. Okay, so a very brief intro to quantum error correction. What is a quantum code? It's just a subspace of the Hilbert space where we encode our information. And if we have a state encoded in the code, what can happen is that there are some errors and they take the state outside the code space. And then what we can do is we may be able to diagnose that errors took the state outside of the code space. How can we do that? With the family of stabilizer codes or subsystem codes, which are very widely used quantum codes, what we do is we measure certain parity checks. Those are Pauli operators. And we extract some classical information. We extract bits that tell us the measurement outcomes of those parity checks. And what we do with this classical bit string is we feed it into decoding algorithms. Decoding algorithms try to figure out what errors might have happened in the system, and they give us a possible recovery operation that will try to undo the detrimental effects of the errors on the encoded state. And this part of the process is called the decoding problem. To formulate it, we say that given the syndrome, the classical bit string, we need to find a recovery operator that maps us back to the code space and does not introduce a logical operator. And here I want to emphasize that this part of the problem, processing of classical information, needs to be fast. And if it's not sufficiently fast, if it cannot keep up with the rate at which the syndrome information is produced, we may run into the so-called backlog problem, and building useful, scalable fault-tolerant quantum computers will not really succeed. And those machines will not be outperforming their classical counterparts. And another remark that I would like to make is that solving the decoding problem in generality for arbitrary stabilizer codes is a computationally hard problem. However, for special codes, like the TOR code that we're about to see, this problem can be solved efficiently. So I will not elaborate too much on the TOR code. We can consider the square lattice. We place qubits on the edges. We have parity checks associated with vertices and faces, X type and Z type. And the code space is plus one eigenspace of the parity checks. So then, since this is a CSS code, we can just measure X parity checks to diagnose Z errors. And for X errors, we measure Z parity checks. Let me focus on Z errors and X parity checks. So if we measure X parity checks, some of them will anti-commute with the error that affected the encoded information. So this is the Z type error. It can be thought of as a string-like object. And in the TOR code, there is this very nice cartoon that tells us what the decoding problem is. We are given some string-like errors, and the syndrome is the endpoints of the strings. Those are the operators that anti-commute with that string-like error. And now you may notice that there are different sets of strings with the same endpoints, and those errors are they can be said to be equivalent if they form contractible loops. Put it in another way, if two errors form a boundary of some region, then they are equivalent because together they form a parity check, a stabilizer. But not all errors are equivalent. In particular, those two errors in light blue and in dark blue are inequivalent. So we have to be careful how we pair up the things. So the decoding problem for the TOR code can be phrased as a matching problem where we have some configuration of point-like syndromes and we want to pair them up without introducing non-contractible loops. So how do we solve this problem? There is the standard solution to this problem called the minimum weight perfect matching algorithm. And this algorithm is used in practice. It has very good performance. It is the gold standard, how we decode the surface code. There could be further improvements to the minimum weight perfect matching decoder. For instance, the belief matching decoder that we thought of a few years ago. And such decoder was actually used in the breakthrough experiment by Google, where they demonstrated that the logical error rate per round scales down if you grow your surface code patch from distance 3 to distance 5. OK, so far, I was not using any information about the structure of the noise. But in certain architectures, there could be some bias. For instance, Z noise can be stronger than X noise or Y noise. And this can appear, for instance, in the bosonic QEC. So what can we do about that? Can we leverage this knowledge of noise? So in particular, here, we don't want to redesign our quantum architecture. We don't want to come up with a different code and different qubit connectivity and different decoders. We want to have some simple tricks that can boost the performance of the code. So what could we do? Well, it's actually very simple. So notice that if our dominant Z noise is Z, then Z party checks do not provide any useful information about this dominant noise because they commute with the errors. So the simple tweak is, instead of measuring Z party checks, we measure Y party checks. And you know, roughly speaking, we increase the sensitivity of the code to the dominant noise. So now, instead of just having the endpoints of the Z string, we also have, you know, all those plaquettes that touch just an odd number of errors. And indeed, this is a very simple idea. There is also a very trivial generalization of this idea. So instead of changing Z checks to Y checks, what we can do is we can Clifford deform any quantum error correcting code. So what I mean by that is we apply some Clifford operations to every single qubit, and we change the Pauli checks that we measure. And we may do that to really improve the logical performance of the code. So does this matter? Is that useful? The answer to that is yes. It can be very useful, especially if you're in the era of small quantum error correction codes and fault-tolerant experiments. So what I illustrate here is an example where we consider all possible variations of the 3x3 surface code, where I apply Clifford operations. And I have some noise where Z errors are dominant and X and Y errors are suppressed by two orders of magnitude. So what we see here is I plot the logical error rate for different codes. And what can be seen from the plot is that the worst performing code is actually the vanilla CSS surface code. And the best performing code has the logical error rate that is two orders of magnitude lower than the standard surface code. So indeed, if you want to squeeze the most out of your small experiment, you better use this degree of freedom to your advantage.
Is the Clifford operator the same for all of the qubits? Or are you changing it?
No. So here, we consider that your Clifford operator is a tensor product of single qubit Clifford operators. So you know, there's plenty of them. But then you will get equivalent codes. So now, a question that you may ask is there any type of bias? Or is there only like Z noise is stronger than X or Y noise? And this brings me to the first part of my talk, namely erasure qubits. One type of noise, a bias, that is quite dominant in quantum computing architectures is the bias between the amplitude damping noise and the dephasing noise. Typically, the amplitude damping time is shorter than the dephasing time. So what is the amplitude damping noise? Well, this noise models a relaxation process from an excited state to the ground state, because that's how we typically define our qubit, as two levels, but one has a slightly higher energy than the other. And this relaxation happens with probability gamma. And it turns out that correcting amplitude damping noise is easier than correcting Pauli noise. And this can be illustrated with the example of the 4-qubit code that is sufficient to correct up to one amplitude damping error. And in contrast, if we were after correcting up to one unknown Pauli error, we would need at least 5 qubits. The other illustration why amplitude damping noise can be considered to be slightly easier than the Pauli noise is the fact that the surface code threshold for the amplitude damping noise is 39%. That's the code capacity threshold. And this should be contrasted with the code capacity threshold for the depolarizing noise that is slightly shy of 19%. So how do we leverage the knowledge that in our system there is amplitude damping noise that is dominant? Well, the idea here is very simple. And the idea of the dual rail code has been in the literature for quite a long time. So what is it? Well, we now, instead of taking 1 qubit, we take 2 qubits and define our effective qubit, or let's call it a dual rail qubit, to be the qubit subspace, to be the subspace spanned by 0, 1, and 1, 0. And then, you know, it's a simple exercise, and I invite you to do it to verify that if we have the amplitude damping noise acting independently on such a composite system, then if we have an encoded state with probability 1 minus gamma, we get the same state back, and with probability gamma, we get the state 0, 0, that is orthogonal to the qubit subspace. And that is very important, because if that state is orthogonal to the qubit subspace, we can, in principle, detect that state. But what this equation is the definition of the heralded erasure noise, which is, you know, with some probability, we get the same state, and with some with 1 minus that probability, we get the state, the flag state, that is orthogonal to our protected state. So the dual rail encoding is a realization of a more general idea of erasure qubits, where we are after engineering qubits in such a way that the dominant noise is mapped to the erasure noise plus some other highly suppressed residual noise. Because what we want to engineer in our system is a bias toward erasure errors. So let's see that correcting erasures is fairly simple. So this is the same example of the Tuareg code. And now we imagine that some erasures happened on qubits depicted in blue. We know that this happens, where this happened. And we can model this process as basically applying single qubit Pauli operators chosen uniformly at random at each location where qubits got erased. And so then we will see some arbitrary syndrome pattern. Any syndrome pattern is possible. What we will see is that stabilizers that touch the locations of erasures may give us -1 outcomes. The other ones cannot, because there are no other errors in the system. And so then the correction is very simple. We just find any correction within the locations of erased qubits. But if we didn't know the locations of erased qubits, we may be tempted to choose the shortest pairing, because, you know, that's what we do with Pauli noise. And that would be the pairing. But this unfortunately would cause a logical error. So leveraging the knowledge of where erasures happen is crucial for the protocol. And it happens that there is a very high threshold for correcting erasures. It is 50%. And you can see that by mapping this decoding problem to the bond percolation problem on the square lattice. But you know, in reality, we wouldn't only have erasure errors in the system. We can also have some Pauli noise, but here the idea is that the Pauli noise would be suppressed compared to the erasure noise. And then we can make some small tweaks to our machinery of the decoders and account for erasure errors and Pauli errors. So what we can do is, let's assume that in the system we have erasure errors that happen with rate E and Pauli errors that happen with rate P. Then what we can find out is we can find out in the EP phase space where the correctable region is. So what's the correctable region? A correctable region is basically a region in the EP space so that, you know, if our erasure rate is at some value E and the erasure and Pauli error rate is at some value P inside the correctable region, then if we scale the system up, then the logical error will go down. So for fault-tolerant quantum computers to work, we have to be in the correctable region. So the intercept on the x-axis in this plot would correspond to 50% because that's the threshold for erasures. The intercept on the y-axis corresponds to 10.5% or whatnot, because that's the code capacity threshold for minimum weight perfect matching. And the boundary of the correctable region interpolates between those points. So what we did in our work is we numerically simulated the heralded erasures and Pauli noise. We considered the circuit noise model with and each element there could introduce Pauli errors with probability P. But then, on top of that, we also added erasure errors. Namely, every C-node may erase both qubits involved in that gate with probability E. And then what we can do is, you know, for a fixed value of E, we scan for different values of P. We plot logical error rate for different code distances, and we find a threshold. And that way, we can map the boundary of the correctable region in the EP plane. And here, what I depict is in light blue is the correctable region for the surface code with erasure qubits, where we do use the information about the about the erasures. The dark region is the correctable region for the surface code, where we discard the information about the erasures and we treat them as unknown Pauli errors. And the take-home message is that with this very small tweak, because it does not really increase the complexity of the decoding problem, we can increase the correctable region by 3.5, by a factor of 3.5. So it can make a difference, right? Because if our computing, our quantum hardware sits somewhere here, using standard methods will be insufficient. If we have erasure qubits with the same error rates, we are in the correctable region. So we just need to scale it up. So we also tested how the sub-threshold scaling of the logical error looks like. So what I plot here is different curves for different different noise strengths as a function of the code distance d. And what we see is that the scaling of the logical error rate for the erasure qubits is the blue solid line can outperform the scaling of the logical error rate for the standard protocols, even when the standard protocols have better error rates, lower error rates. And so the punchline here is that with those simple tricks, we can lower the logical error rate and subsequently reduce the qubit overhead of our quantum error correction protocol. So now you may be wondering, wait a second. The erasure scheme uses more resources than the standard scheme, right? Because I had those two qubits coupled together to form an effective qubit. So, you know, is the comparison really fair? And, you know, this is a very valid question. But it's slightly more subtle here. So we can realize the erasure scheme via this dual rail encoding. And for such erasure qubit, we will use two transmons and one readout resonator. In the standard transmon architecture, to realize one qubit, we would use one transmon and one readout resonator. And fortunately for us, transmons do not occupy a lot of space on chips. So the complexity of such a chip would be only moderately increased compared to the standard scheme. And another point to make is that with the erasure scheme, we can so if we allow ourselves that we can use n transmons, and then with the erasure scheme, we can realize the surface code that will be able to correct up to root n over 4 erasures. And for the standard scheme, we would be able to realize a surface code that can correct up to root n over 8 unknown Pauli errors. So we win here as well. Those findings are not specific to the surface code. We also tested, you know, erasure qubits with other codes, for instance, Floquet codes. Floquet codes are quite nice because they can be realized with weight 2 Pauli measurements, XX, ZZ. In principle, the erasure checks that we need to realize erasure qubits, they can also be realized with projective Pauli ZZ measurements. To realize Floquet codes with erasure qubits, all that we need to do is the ability to do single qubit rotations and weight 2 projective Pauli ZZ measurements. So we, in this approach, we reduce the number of basic operations that we need to engineer and optimize at the hardware level. Let me also make a comment about an assumption that I made earlier in the talk. Namely, I assume that I know exactly where erasures happened. This doesn't have to be the case. So in particular, we can have false positive and false negative erasure detections. What they will do is they will effectively change what the erasure rate is and what the Pauli rate is in the system. But nothing funky happens here. If a point to make is, if we don't know when erasures happened exactly, we may not able to be reset them back to the qubit subspace immediately. You know, there may be some delay. And this will cause erasures to spread. And this further complicates the problem, but nothing fundamental really changes. And what we get from all those studies is the following rule of thumb. If we want to have quantum error correction protocols based on erasure qubits, we better have the following noise rates. We need to have erasure rates around 1%, Pauli rates around 0.1%, and false positive, false negative erasure detection rates to be around 1%. So I hope that at this point I convince you that erasure qubits can be valuable. But a burning question now is, can we realize them in practice? So in the past few years, there have been quite a few works that address this question. Erasure qubits can be realized, for instance, with neutral atoms. And this approach is pursued by the group at Princeton. So here, the erasure qubit is defined as two metastable electronic levels such that gate errors lead to transitions into some disjoint subspaces whose populations can be continuously monitored. And if those errors happen, we will know about them. And we can also realize erasure qubits with superconducting architectures. For instance, the group at Yale considers coupled microwave cavities, in our work, we considered resonantly coupled transmons. And the key idea here is again, this very simple idea that amplitude damping noise is or causes detectable leakage to the zero-zero state. So in order to benefit from the idea of erasure qubits, we have to satisfy the following requirements. First, we have to make sure that in our system there is large erasure noise bias, defined as the ratio of erasure noise to other noise in the system. And the second requirement that we have to meet is that we are able to detect erasure errors without introducing further errors in the system. And in our recent experiment, we demonstrated that erasure qubits via the dual rail encoding meet both requirements. So I will not elaborate too much on the experimental demonstration, but I just want to give you the highlights. So first, to verify that we do have a large erasure noise bias, we performed a single-qubit randomized benchmarking protocol interspersed with frequent erasure checks. And what we saw is that the erasure rate was of the order of 4 × 10⁻³, whereas the residual error rate post-selecting on no erasures happening in the system was around 10⁻⁴. So what we demonstrated here is that indeed we have a large erasure bias of the order of 40. In order to verify the ability to detect erasure errors, we first estimated the false positive and false negative detection rates. What we did here is we prepared the state either in the dual rail qubit subspace, performed the erasure check, and then measured the dual rail qubit, or prepared the state in the zero-zero state that is orthogonal to the qubit subspace, performed the erasure check, and measured the state. And what we saw is that those false positive and false negative error rates were around 10⁻². And lastly, what we did is we performed repeated erasure checks in some fixed period of time, and we saw that the dephasing due to those erasure checks was below 10⁻³. So take-home message is that the performance that we've seen with this very simple experiment is already compatible with the QEC targets on the erasure qubits. Are there any questions?
Maybe somewhat naive, but with the transmon setup, is there a reason why you have to use two transmons as opposed to just using four of the levels of the one transmon, like you kind of do with neutral atoms?
You can use more levels in one transmon, and this is also what we consider in our paper. You can use three levels. So basically, your qubit will be defined as the E and F state, G and F state, and E will be used as a flag. But then the question is, you know, how do you do gates? Is this more noise robust? You know, using the third level, will that have higher chances to leak to yet another level? So it you know, we believe that the dual rail encoding is better. But you know, in principle, there's no problem.
I mean, like, could you use the dual rail with the trans? Like, if you use four levels of the transmon, because you need like some four level space to do the dual rail, right? So could you just do that with a single transmon of four levels, or
that could be an idea? Yeah, but you know, the devil sits in the detail.
So with the dual rail encoding, then a lot of your, like, at that logical level of those two qubits, a lot of your gates become two-qubit gates instead of one-qubit gates, right?
So, you know, a gate is an abstraction, right? In reality, you have some Hamiltonian that describes the system. You couple certain transmons. You know, you crank up the coupling strength. Yes?
Yeah. I just mean, like, so, like, a lot of these operations you're doing on that dual-rail encoding are now, like, multi-body.
They could be more complex. That's right.
And then this, you know, it's like two qubit gates are like an order of magnitude worse than one qubit gates. So
Not necessarily.
listen to the analysis.
Not necessarily, but this is something to be tested, yes. And this is what we're working on, right? To demonstrate high fidelity gates between dual rail qubits.
It's very nice that you're already within like the region you want to be with the error rates, but do they think they can push this bias further?
I think our setup was, you know, was just to demonstrate the idea, and now it's, you know, it's indefinite improvement. You know, we will continue to improve.
So if we assume this sort of bias, then as you're showing, we should be able to get like hopefully better thresholds for our codes. But if we were to sort of turn it the other way around and say, given to run a certain algorithm, we need the error to be below some bound. If we were to assume this, if we were to take like the surface code, then presumably we would be able to use lower distance codes now. So my sort of question is, have you looked at sort of the comparative resources in terms of like the size of a computer we would have using this?
That's a great question, and this is kind of a topic of ongoing research. Okay, so.
Sorry. Just I'm curious, like, is there some other way to correct amplitude damping noise instead of like converting it to the erasure noise?
You could, right? It's a question of how you simulate one quantum channel with another quantum channel. Basically, that's the question you're asking about. So here we're kind of mapping it to erasure noise because I would argue it's as classical as it gets. And therefore, it's easy to correct because it simplifies quantum error correction protocols. Okay, I think it's a good point to transition to the second part of my talk, which is how to reduce the time overhead of quantum error correction. So unfortunately, quantum error correction protocols are themselves noisy processes. So we fight errors, but we may also introduce some more errors into the system. So we better be careful here. And in particular, the information about the syndrome may be incorrect. And a lot that I covered in my previous part assumed that the priority checks were correct. And for instance, when we discussed the decoding problem for the Torah code, we assumed that the syndrome is reliable. But if the syndrome is unreliable, we missed one measurement outcome, we will be unable to pair those point-like excitations. So what do we do? Well, it's that this problem is a well-known problem with well-known solutions. So one very simple approach is just to repeat measurements. We repeat syndrome measurements multiple times, and we build some confidence in the measurement outcomes. Unfortunately, this simple strategy results in the so-called QEC-induced slowdown, because we have to repeat measurements some number of times, usually proportional to the code distance. So the logical clock speed would be reduced by a factor of d compared to the physical clock speed. So that's not good. And if we repeat measurements, we also may be vulnerable to time-correlated errors. So we can avoid repeating measurements, and there have been quite a few ideas how to do it. However, if those ideas are applied to the surface code architecture that, you know, we are trying to use to build quantum computers, then we will have to sacrifice geometric locality of priority checks and some priority checks that we have to measure would become macroscopic. So that's not that good because we really want to work with the planar architecture. So what I want to tell you about is, you know, something that unfortunately doesn't live in two dimensions, but it lives in three dimensions. So that should be okay, right? our space is, you know, three-dimensional. And so it's the idea of the 3D subsystem toric code. And this is an example of a new topological quantum code that is capable of single-shot quantum error correction. So what is single-shot quantum error correction? It's this idea that we can perform error correction even if our measurements are unreliable. We just measure our syndrome once. And even though those outcomes may be unreliable, we can still proceed with reliable quantum error correction. And here in this code, we have basically three spatial dimensions. Our code is geometrically local in three spatial dimensions. We measure checks once. They are geometrically local there. And we can do error correction. And if we operate with codes that have single-shot quantum error correction property, there will be no QEC-induced slowdown. So our logical clock speed will be comparable to the physical clock speed. So that's good.
So by the way, why we need the D factor in front of T physical?
Yes. Yeah, so you know, if you want your quantum error correction gadget to be fault tolerant, you have to make sure that you can account for measurement errors.
Right.
So if you make fewer measurements, you would be unable to identify certain measurement errors that happen in the QEC gadget.
Just log over D would be enough to suppress.
But they can accumulate, right? Because one QEC gadget does not necessarily talk to the other QEC gadget. So they could, those adversarially chosen errors could work against you. Okay, so what's the 3D subsystem toric code? Well, I will be very brief, but if you want to know more about the model, there is Mike in the back row, and you should ask him. So the model can be defined on the cubic lattice. We place qubits on the edges. And one simple observation I want to make is that the cubic lattice can be colored into colors, red and blue. And this is important because we will associate party checks with blue and red volumes. Blue volumes will correspond to Z checks, and red volumes will correspond to X checks. And in particular, we will have weight 3 parity checks that look like that. Blue depicts Z, red depicts X. So this is what the model looks in the bulk. On the boundary, we have to make some adjustment. It may look a little bit more complex, but it's not really that complex. And those details are not that essential. So now, if you pay a close attention, you may notice that, for instance, this Z check overlaps only on one qubit with that X check. Therefore, they would anti-commute. So isn't that a problem? No, it's not a problem, because it's not a stabilizer code. It's a subsystem code. So with subsystem codes, we measure parity checks that may anti-commute. Nevertheless, there are stabilizer operators in the model. And stabilizer operators, by definition, commute with all parity checks that we measure. And we can form stabilizer operators in the model by multiplying. So those would be the stabilizer operators. We can form them by multiplying 4 parity checks, either this group of parity checks or the other group of parity checks. Stabilizer operators in this model will be of weight 12. And they are the ones that provide useful syndrome information that we use for error correction. On the high level, the decoding problem in the subsystem toric code, in the 3D subsystem toric code, is very similar to the 2D toric code decoding problem. We have errors that can be thought of as string-like objects, and the syndrome corresponds to their endpoints, as depicted here. Errors and the syndrome. And so this is what our quantum error correction protocol sees. This is the input. We don't know where errors happen. However, there's a small twist to the problem. And so here, We measure stabilizer operators indirectly. We measure party checks. So we have more information, actually. So notice, you know, I can form a stabilizer operator either by multiplying the party checks colored in yellow or the party checks colored in green. So notice that there is some redundancy in the measurements that I make. And namely, if I multiply all party checks, yellow and green, they will form the identity operator. So this is equivalent to saying that if I multiply the measurement outcomes of yellow and green party checks, and you know, they individually may give me plus minus one outcomes, but the product of their outcomes will has to be plus one. So there is this local constraint, which is the origin of the so-called Gauss's law. So now I can think of party checks that gave me minus one measurement outcomes as some loop-like objects, as depicted here. I will refer to those objects as the flux. And the Gauss law tells me that the party check outcomes, they have to form closed loops. And the syndrome, I don't have time to elaborate on that, but the syndrome can be found as places where the yellow flux turns into the green flux. So this is how the decoding problem can be set up for the 3D subsystem toric code. So on the previous slide, there were no measurement errors, but in reality, there will be. So instead of seeing some closed loops, we will see some strings. So some broken loops. But now the idea for the decoder is very simple. It will be a two-stage decoder. In the first stage, what we will do is we will make sure that our loops are closed. There are no open strings in the bulk. The strings may be anchored at the boundary of the system, but that's just a technicality. So in the first step, we just repair possibly broken loops. And if we have this fixed configuration of the flux, we can reliably estimate the syndrome. And then using the syndrome, we will pair it up in the same way as we did for the 2D toric code. And importantly, both steps can be done with the minimum wave perfect matching decoder, which is computationally efficient. So, you know, you can numerically test it.
So what are the logical operators in this subsystem?
So logical operators, as you know, would be, because it's a subsystem, so there would be bare logical operators and dressed logical operators. The ones that matter for the from the perspective of quantum error correction would be dressed logical operators, and they would be strings. The bare logical operators would be sheets.
They somehow anti-coherent?
That's right. So the sheets, so two bare logical operators at x and z, would be, or you know, two representatives of bare logical operators, x and z, could be formed by taking two sides of the cube, and they would kind of on the top boundary they would correspond to logical x and logical z of the of the toric code.
So boundary is very important here.
The boundary is quite nasty. That's why you know Mike and I had the bulk you know in like 5 minutes, but then finding the boundary was maybe you know 5 months. Okay, so you know you can numerically benchmark it, but in the but I don't have time, so I'll skip it. But I want to tell you a few words about proving single shot error correction in the model. So what the single shot decoder does is it suppresses the errors in the system, but it does not remove all the errors from the system. So it keeps the noise under control. So proving single shot error correction is basically proving that statement, and that single shot decoding keeps the errors from accumulating the system. So it can be put into an equation, and the theorem can say for sufficiently small parameters eta and tau, eta captures the measurement error rate in the single shot decoder, tau measures the physical error rate of the noise. There exist parameters tau prime and delta that tell us about the structure of the residual noise, such that we have the following inclusion. And so R here this models the single shot decoder, and N here models the local stochastic noise that is in the system, and pi here is the code projector. So okay, now we know what the statement is, so let me unpack it a little. So what the theorem says is that suppose that we start with a code in the code space, then some local stochastic noise is applied to the state encoded in the code space, followed by single shot decoder. So what we ask is, what is the output state of this process? And what the theorem says is that the output state here can be thought of as a state encoded in the code space for which we applied some local stochastic noise with parameters slightly changed with respect to the parameters of the local stochastic noise here. So this statement so far is pre-tautological. So the non-trivial part of the statement is how the parameters of the local stochastic noise on this side scale as a function of the parameters of the noise here, tau, eta, and epsilon. So in particular, the residual noise is suppressed if measurement errors are suppressed. And so basically in the limit of perfect measurements, the noise, the physical noise strength of the local stochastic noise that is left in the system would go to zero. And the second non-trivial statement is that the increase of the logical error rate that is captured by the second parameter of the local stochastic noise, epsilon. So here we have epsilon, here's epsilon plus delta. This increment, delta, will vanish if we keep increasing the system size. And then we can ask, you know, what happens if we do repeated rounds of single-shot quantum error correction, and then the noise will stay tau-bounded all the time, and logical error rate will grow linearly in the number of repetitions.
So it doesn't repeated rounds of single-shot error correction defeat the... I feel like I'm misinterpreting.
That's a good question. So what we're talking about is, you know, quantum error correction gadget. Mm-hmm. So when you run your circuit, you will insert a lot of quantum error correction gadgets. And on one side, your quantum error correction gadget will have to be repeated rounds of, you know, say, surface code measurements. The other gadget is, you know, you just have the 3D subsystem toric code, and within this gadget, you measure once. So this is what we're comparing. But now, you know, when we talk about repeated rounds of QEC here, what we really mean is, you know, repeated QEC gadgets.
Are the repeated, are the QEC gadgets like sequential, like one right after another?
So, you know, in the actual circuit, you know, they will be interspersed with logical operators.
Okay, so.
Okay, so I'll skip this slide. And in the last 5 minutes of the talk, I just want to give you a glimpse of how single-shot error correction appears in other codes. So far in the talk, we talked about topological codes, and those are great codes. They can be realized, you know, in our world, you know, in two-dimensional architectures or maybe three-dimensional architectures. But unfortunately, there are certain limitations on those codes. In particular, if I consider a system in d dimensions, then the number of physical qubits will scale as L to the D. L is the linear size of the system. But then the number of encoded qubits will scale as L to the D minus 2, and the distance of the code will scale as L to the power of D minus 1. But this should be But we know from the early days of quantum error correction that good quantum error correcting codes exist. And what is meant here by good is the following scaling of code parameters. We can have quantum error correcting codes for which the number of encoded qubits is proportional to the number of physical qubits, so is the distance. So clearly, because of those limitations on the topological codes, we cannot have good topological quantum codes. So we have to give up something. And it turns out that all that we have to give up is geometric locality. We still require that parity checks are of constant weight. They just cannot be arranged on some d-dimensional lattice and be geometrically local on that lattice. So this is the family of quantum LDPC codes. And recent breakthrough results showed us that good quantum LDPC codes exist. So one example of a good quantum LDPC code is quantum tunnel codes. And those codes are defined based on some graph-like structure called a left-right Cayley complex. And another ingredient to define quantum tunnel codes is a pair of local classical codes. And combining those two ingredients, we can get quantum tunnel codes. I will not get into the details, but what I would like to tell you about is what we proved. So we proved that the decoding for quantum tunnel codes, those codes can be decoded in single-shot fashion. So what's the how do we decode quantum tunnel codes? I cannot really tell you because I didn't define those codes, but I'll just give you a very rough intuition. And the intuition will be centered around the 3D toric code, stabilizer toric code. So 3D stabilizer toric code can have qubits on faces, X checks on edges, and Z checks on volumes. And the decoding problem for the 3D stabilizer toric code for Z errors can be thought of as we're given some, that there are some sheet-like errors, and their signature is some loop-like syndromes. So instead of having point-like syndromes, we now have loop-like syndromes. And now we need to fill up those loop-like syndromes with some patches, like that. It turns out that to decode this type of syndrome, we can work with local decoders. So we have some local agents placed at every location of the lattice, and those local agents have access to just local information about the syndrome. And if we do repeated rounds of measurements, they will be able to correct things. But we have to be careful to make sure that local agents do not undo corrections of the other agents. And basically, that's the idea of how quantum tunnel codes can be decoded. There is some local greedy decoder to reduce the syndrome, but then there is a follow-up step that tries to reduce the mismatch of what local agents may do. But in the work of Leverrier and Zemmour, what they did is analyze the case of noiseless syndrome. So what we did is we basically proved that with this decoder, we can operate in a single-shot fashion. We proved a statement similar to the statement that I discussed with the context of the 3D subsystem toric codes. We have repeated rounds of error correction. And you know, if certain conditions are met, that the residual noise at the end stays under control. And importantly, this is the first time where the distinction between adversarial noise and local stochastic noise disappeared because the codes have good parameters. Okay, now my time is up, so let me summarize. In the talk, we were talking about methods of reducing the overhead of quantum error correction. And in the first part, we talked about the idea of erasure qubits that help us to reduce the qubit overhead. And here, the idea was to convert the dominant noise into heralded erasures. And in the context of superconducting circuits, this leads to hardware-efficient quantum error correction protocol. In the second part of the talk, we looked at the idea how to reduce time overhead of quantum error correction by using single-shot approach. And this approach can handle efficiently measurement errors. And we looked at examples with topological and quantum LDPC codes. So you know, the quest of reducing the overhead of quantum error correction is by no means done. And there are still many questions open. We need to design codes. We need to think of their implementation of, on the hardware. And we need to think about how to do logical gates on the encoded information. So if you're interested in those questions, please reach out to me. And with that, I would like to thank you for your talk, for your time.
Further questions for Alex?
So for the 3D subsystem code, does the decoding threshold have a nice static mapping? And is it related to the one measurement?
It can be understood as the threshold of a corresponding stabilizer code, and
And also, is this single shot quantum error correction is it related in some way to fault tolerant measurement based quantum computation? What is the relation between?
You mean MBQC? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. So, basically, if you start thinking about trading one spatial dimension in this 3D model for time, this could be thought of as an evolution of the 2D 2D code in time. So there are all those tricks, you know, 2 plus 1 equals 3 plus 0.
Could you go back to the last slide on the LDPC code? Basically, I was a little bit confused about what you added, I guess.
Right.
And then you did this single shot.
Yes. So what was done by Leverrier and Zemmour is that they came up with a decoder for quantum tunnel codes. So they assumed perfect syndrome, and how do we go back to the code space? What we did here is we proved that even if you have measurement errors, then there's a small modification of the decoder that allows you to proceed. And in particular, you can proceed in a single shot fashion, that you have those snapshots of the system, and with imperfect syndrome, you can still do reliable error correction. And compare to the statement for the 3D subsystem toric code, the difference is with the subsystem toric code, we had to assume that noise is local stochastic, meaning the higher the weight of the error, the more suppressed it is. It's exponentially suppressed in its weight. Here, for the first time, this distinction between local stochastic and adversarial disappears, because what we assume here is that the weight of the error has to be smaller than some constant fraction of the system. So it could be proportional to the number. So you can have the number of errors that is proportional to the number of physical qubits. And an adversary can choose it. This cannot be the case with topological codes, because the distance there scales only linearly in the system size. So that's another component.
So have you constructed the actual algorithm, or is it sort of just a proof that this is possible?
No. So there's an explicit algorithm. And the algorithm is basically those local corrections combined with some procedure to reconcile disagreements of local corrections.
So, for example, if you don't want to do single-shot decoding, you are satisfied with, for example, this D overhead. And is it straightforward to come up with a decoding algorithm for this LDPC code, or?
So, in general, with most codes, you could just repeat measurements, and then you could bootstrap the existing algorithm pretty much. Maybe there are certain details to figure out, but it should not be that challenging. But if your distance is, you know, proportional to the number of physical qubits, the time overhead may be huge.
I was just kind of curious about like experimental realizations of 3D codes. Like, what do people think that will look like?
Oh yeah, that's a great question. So I didn't address that in the talk, but over the past 2 years or so, we've witnessed an enormous progress in neutral atoms, and those are, you know, very well suited architectures where, you know, you may have an array of a 2D array of atoms, but a great thing about this architecture is that you can rearrange your atoms, so you can very easily emulate those 3D structures.
Yeah, a couple announcements. So a reminder that Alex has another talk at 4:30 at IQC that you might want to check out. And there's a colloquium today at 2 by Turin Grover that maybe people here might be interested in. And everyone's welcome to join us for lunch in the Bistro after this. So let's thank Alex again.